On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. If you're a teenage or 20-something American male, it may be the catchphrase of the year, drawn from ancient history and a new Hollywood blockbuster. Spartans, tonight we dine in hell, is the campy call drawn from the box office hit 300. It's the buffed-up version of the Battle of Thermopylae, 480 BC, Spartans versus Persians, the few against the many. Critics hate it, so does Iran, heir of Persia, but it's a smash. Up next on Point, we'll roll the real history behind the film, the real story of ancient Greece, classic heroism, death, glory, and propaganda in 300. We go in a moment to the historian and to views from Greece and the heirs of Persia. But joining me first today from New York City is Ian Moore, box office editor for Variety magazine. Ian, thanks a lot for being with us. Remind us of what this film 300 is doing out there.
Well, this film 300 has really become a huge sensation, more than anyone could have imagined. I mean, the main thing to remember is it was made very cheaply. You know, as you said, it was shot in a warehouse in Montreal, and it cost about $65 million.
It doesn't look like, I mean, it's against a blue screen. They draw in all the mountains and the raging skies and seas, but actually done in a warehouse.
Exactly. And, you know, with no stars, shot in Canada, it cost $65 million, and it's made, you know, $162 million here, and it looks like it'll probably do about $500 million worldwide. So, you know, it's certainly the type of film that a studio would be pretty high on.
Number one in the U.S. the weekend it came out, now number two, but still number one globally. It reached the $100 million mark for box office in 7 days. Only The Matrix Reloaded and The Passion of the Christ have done it more quickly. How is the film industry interpreting the draw of this film?
Well, I think that this film represents Hollywood doing a better job of marketing films sort of through the internet. You know, this is a film that appeals to kind of the video game playing generation and the graphic novel reading generation. Those are people that are hard to get into movie theaters and people that Hollywood was worried were, you know, going away from theaters and traditional films. So this is sort of a movie that's gotten them out to the multiplexes.
Ian, for those who haven't seen it, describe the look and feel of this film. It's unique. That kind of video game digital quality, even with the grand spectacle, is very evident on the screen.
Yeah, I mean, it's a movie that actually really looks like a video game. It has this sort of surreal look. And if anyone out there sort of seen Sin City, which was another adaptation of a graphic novel by Frank Miller, who did 300, that sort of seemed to be the template for the way that this film looks. It looks like you're inside a comic book, basically.
So the New York Observer says 300 gym-hardened Aryan muscle men in leather Speedo swimming trunks behind their metal shields. It did come from a graphic novel, then up onto the screen. This reach back into history, what about that? I mean, I guess Braveheart and many others have reached back, for that matter. The Passion of the Christ reached back and made a lot of money. But are we now mining deep in ancient history in Hollywood as a promising vein?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, you probably wouldn't have known this. I mean, I certainly didn't. But this particular battle is kind of was a popular legend with sort of the D&D crowd and sort of you know, readers of these Frank Miller graphic novels. So yeah, it seems like an unlikely way to get material. But then again, there was a resurgence of the swords and sandals epics with Troy and Gladiator, and those films did pretty well too. So I guess this is like the next step in that trend.
Now they're back for the video game generation. Big box office, Hollywood taking big notice. Ian Moore from Variety magazine. Ian, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks, Tom.
Let's go to the scholarship now on this ancient history. Joining us from Ithaca, New York, Barry Strauss. He's professor of history and classics at Cornell University, author of The Trojan War and the Battle of Salamis. He often lectures at the Naval War College and at Annapolis on history and strategy, warfare, Greek martial culture. Professor Strauss, Barry Strauss, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Have you seen the movie? And as a classics professor, did you come out? Well, how did you come out?
I have seen the movie. And undoubtedly, my reaction was colored by the fact that I was there with my kids, including my 14-year-old son. I thought it was entertaining. It's certainly not very good history, but it's entertaining.
Take us into the actual history here. The Battle of
Thermopylae. Who was meeting whom and under what circumstances, and why has it become such a legendary sort of a touch point for military historians and cultural, for that matter?
Well, Thermopylae is a classic last stand, a very heroic one, and described in moving terms by the historian Herodotus, not just a father of history, but a great storyteller. Mm. It was a battle between, on the one hand, a Greek coalition, and on the other, a Persian-led coalition. Persian Empire, huge empire, biggest in the world.
At that time, stretching from what, Pakistan to Macedonia, Egypt, gigantic.
Absolutely, absolutely. Estimated 20 million people out of an estimated 100 million people on Earth.
So one out of five Persians at that time, and the reason Iranians pay so much attention today is essentially Iran was the center of the Persian Empire.
Yes, the Persians were an Iranian people.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so here comes this vast army under the Emperor Xerxes, and of course it's the mismatch that made it the epic story. Why would 300 Spartans plus, it must be said, some more Greeks along, why would they take on this vast army of 150,000 or something like that?
Yeah, probably there were about 150,000 soldiers, give or take, in the Persian army, and there were about 7,000 Greeks at Thermopylae. I mean, Thermopylae was in many ways an accidental battle. The Greek coalition had put together a strategy, a joint land-sea strategy of fighting the Persians. The question was, where were they going to make the stand and when? The Spartans were not eager to fight so far away from home in central Greece.
Sparta is well to the south. Thermopylae. Athens, closer, but well to the east. This is kind of tucked into the geographic center of Greece there.
Yes, Athens is closer. And the Spartans had a problem. In order to keep the coalition together, they had to make some kind of stand north of Athens in central Greece, and north of Thebes as well, to try to keep Greek city-states in the coalition.
Otherwise, they were afraid that the city-states would break apart and they'd be easy marks for this gigantic Persian army.
Exactly.
So what, did they send up a token 300 knowing that it was likely to be annihilated, or was the annihilation fate, a tough accident?
Well, you know, this question of whether they thought they'd be annihilated or not is one that historians don't have the answer to. Myself, I think they knew it was a very risky mission. I don't think they thought it was necessarily going to be a suicide mission. It was reasonable to think that 7,000 Greeks could hold the pass for a short period until reinforcements came from the south. And remember, the Spartans and other Greeks were planning to send reinforcements. At the time, there was a religious festival as well as the Olympic festival going on. And they said that for religious reasons, they wanted to hold off sending their army. We don't know if that's true or if it was just an excuse. We do know wartime makes people more religious. But it wasn't completely crazy to think that they could make a temporary stand at this pass and then be reinforced.
So is it,
in any case,
from what we know from Herodotus, is there any question that the confrontation took place, that it was few against many, and that the few had some significant impact, a heroic even impact?
Well, those are good questions. There's no question that the confrontation took place. The Greeks stood in the pass for 3 days and fought off the Persians, and some of them, the Spartans, the Thespians, some Thebans against their will, and Spartan serfs heroically stayed, and many of them fought to the death against the Persians. That's factual. The impact of Thermopylae is a little more debatable. It's clear that it inspired the Greek spirit of resistance, that Spartans, including a Spartan king, should be willing to die for this cause, I think, made a huge impression on people. It bought a little time for the Greeks to gather their forces together to the south, but it was not in and of itself decisive in this war.
You've written about the battle that was decisive. It took place not long after and on sea, not land.
Right. While the Greeks were fighting at Thermopylae, they were also fighting at sea 40 miles away at Artemisium. But they retreated to Athens, where off the shore of Athens within the site of Acropolis, about a month later, they fought a naval battle. This is one in which the Spartans participated, but the Athenians played the main role. And this battle destroyed the heart of the Persian fleet. That forced the Persian king to go home, Xerxes. It forced a large part of the Persian army to go home. What was left in Greece was a rump Persian army. Mm. And the next year, a Greek land army both Athenians and Spartans, but led by Spartans, this land army, now facing a much smaller Persian army, was able to finish the job. So Salamis was really the turning point rather than Thermopylae being the turning point.
And as a historian, we'll talk more about this, but before we go to a break, I want to get your big take. The movie, and much before, presents this as an epic confrontation between light and dark, good and evil, freedom and slavery. As an historian, do you see it that way?
Well, no. I mean, I think that's an exaggeration, and I don't think Herodotus would have seen it that way, except that he would have seen it as a confrontation between freedom and slavery. The Greeks were fighting for their freedom, as they understood it. I think in their terms, they were fighting for their independence and autonomy. They did not want to be subject to outsiders. The Persians, on the other hand, believed that they had this great empire, that the Greeks had challenged this empire. They wanted them to become part of this empire.
Let's listen to just a little bit from the film here. Actor Gerald Butler playing King Leonidas at full throttle here, telling his men that the narrow pass at Thermopylae is the place the Greeks will make their stand and earn their place in history.
This is where we hold them! This is where we fight! This is where they die! And these shield boys! Remember this day, men. For it will be yours for all time.
Ooh, 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 from 300 there. Barry Strauss, what about the cultural representations here? The way the Spartans look in this film, the way they communicate with one another, the way they act, the way they fight. How did you find it as an historian?
The reality was somewhat different. The Spartans, first of all, they wore heavy armor. Heavy metal armor.
And they are famously practically naked and very buff in this digitally enhanced
300. That's not the way it really happened. It was really very different. They'd be carrying as much as 50 to 70 pounds of armor. Mm-hmm. They'd be fully clad and protected. They certainly were a famously militaristic culture. They were elite warriors. They were famous for making very short speeches, short and pithy statements. This is where we get our term laconic from.
So when the king says to Xerxes, who said, lay down your weapons, he essentially said, come and get them. That's the kind of thing Spartans might have said. You want them, come and get them?
Absolutely. Yes, that's plausible that Spartans would say something like that. They're famous for it. It's their trademark.
It's interesting on the sort of semi-nudity part here. While that might not be the way they fought, I've read somewhere that there is, in fact, even in Greece, a tradition of representing warriors in kind of heroic nudity, so the body could be on display when battles were later drawn, put on vases, and all the rest.
That's absolutely correct. They would often, even usually, represent their warriors in this way. So to that extent, that is accurate. But certainly that wasn't the reality.
Tell us about the Spartan culture itself and the degree of its militarism. And there's a kind of irony here when it comes to talking about freedom and slavery. There was a lot of slavery in the Spartan culture.
Yes, indeed, and in ancient Greece in general. Sparta was a society with it was a class society. There were three classes. There were full Spartan citizens, the so-called Spartiates, maybe about 8,000 men at this time, heads of families. They were fully free, full citizens. There was a second group, the so-called neighbors. They were not enslaved, but they did not have full citizen rights. And finally, at the bottom, there were the serfs, or the helots. They were not free at all. They were a very large group of people, and they did the heavy lifting for the Spartans, freeing the Spartans for military pursuits. So in that sense, it wasn't a free society, nor was it a democracy. Sparta was a society with a strong sense of obedience, order, and knowing your place. Ironically, it's a society in which women in ancient Greece probably had the most freedom. And by the standards of the ancient world, it's one of the societies with the freest women. Spartan women were free to vent their opinions. Their opinions were regarded well. They were respected. Mm-hmm. Their education was that they had a public education, unlike the rest of Greece. They were trained to exercise and even to exercise in the nude, to wrestle naked. Which was considered scandalous by the rest of Greece.
Talking liberated women here. And as for the young men, what, as I remember my history, into military training incredibly young and for a very long time. That was their life.
Yes, full Spartan citizens at the age of 7 would be taken away from their homes and they would be removed to a barracks. And that would be their home to the age of 18. And there they would have a very rough, tough training where they were taught to be the best infantrymen in the world and very, very successfully.
What about the rest of ancient Greece? Athenians, famous for their democracy in our history and our telling, how did they see Sparta? Did they seem as sort of over-the-top militarists, as a little nutty in that way, or admirable, or how?
Well, you know, probably the average Athenian was not real fond of Sparta, thought that Athenian democracy, which gave ordinary citizens freedom and the ability to express their opinion, to vote, and to take part in the government, they saw that as a better and juster society. But there was a minority of Athenians who admired the Spartans. They were Spartophiles, if you will. They admired their austerity and thought that the Spartans were the true representatives of Greek virtue. And I think one of the cards that the Spartans played, indeed, was Thermopylae, that there was an occasion where the Spartans famously sacrificed themselves for the good of the cause and the good of the whole. And that was one of the things about Sparta that Greeks admired.
Let me ask you, as an historian, as I recall in my youth, when we were pointed back to look at ancient Greece, it was always Athens we were pointed to as the American model, as the place that our democracy would resonate with. Now here we are in 2007, and the militaristic Spartans are being held up, at least in popular culture here, as, you know, a kind of a super iconic representations of heroism and nobility. Does that strike you as weird, good, bad? Does it give you pause? Have we drifted to a new model?
Well, you know, in a way, we've returned to an old model. I mean, if you look at the American map, there are a whole lot of Spartas, Spartanburgs,
yes,
Spartan
true.
Towns.
Yeah, yeah.
And there are many high school and college teams called the Spartans. There are not that many teams called the Athenians. I mean, Sparta has always resonated, or has long resonated, as an example of a warrior society. As you may know, there's a novel about Thermopylae by Stephen Pressfield, Gates mm-hmm. of Fire, that's very popular with Marines. There's always been a strong attachment to Sparta. But as a historian, I think it's not the whole story. Certainly, Sparta, Spartan valor and virtue did mm-hmm. not win the Persian Wars alone. You need Athens. You need a society of innovation, of freedom, and a society that's willing to think outside the box to come up with this navy and this new naval strategy, mm-hmm. for example.
Maurice is calling from Virginia Beach, Virginia. Hi, Maurice. You're on the air.
Hi, how you doing?
Very well. Have you seen it, Maurice? What do you think?
Good. Actually, I'm sorry. Maurice had to run away, so he handed the phone to a friend of his, actually.
Oh, so we've handed off from Athenians to Spartans here, or vice versa. Who are we speaking with?
Yes, my name's Perel.
Okay, Perel, what do you make of the history and the movie?
Well, I don't have as much as the history as Maurice had as far as the in school with the Spartans and everything, but I felt that the movie had the purpose is what really kind of moved me, because the purpose that I got out of the movie was, even though these soldiers or these warriors knew that they were going to reach their end or their demise, mm-hmm. they weren't going to win, but they put everything, effort, whatever they had, into defending what they believed they held true.
So you got the message just as the filmmaker intended it. Terrell, let me ask you something. I couldn't help noticing in the film that the Spartans were kind of represented as these very sort of white, Aryan, very muscular guys. The Persians were represented as dark and weird and cruel and strange, but notably dark. Did you see a racial message in this film?
Well, I didn't myself. This is just for myself personally speaking. Mm-hmm. I didn't really see it as in that aspect, as in any kind of a racial, any kind of way. Not myself. I didn't see it. I just saw it as one side that stood for freedom, stood for liberty, stood for, you know, just wanting to maintain, you know, a certain kind of code of ethics. And I saw another side that fought for greed, fought for wealth, fought for power. And that's how I saw it.
And the smaller band, ready to die for it. Terrell, you're a generous viewer, and we appreciate your time. Your thoughts, Barry Strauss, how about the representations of the two sides here, visually and culturally, the sort of white-brown divide that Hollywood has brought here, and also the Persian character presented here as very tyrannical, very corrupt?
Yes, I mean, the Persians certainly are presented as darker people in general than the Greeks, but they're not always presented as people. I mean, they have they're monsters on their side. They've got elephants. They've got rhinoceroses.
In this digital version, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it goes very far away from the realm of reality into the realm of fantasy. And as you said, it's like a video game. It's certainly not what the Persian army was really all about. There would have no doubt been a lot of greed and corruption in the Persian army, but there was also a sense of mission, of purpose, of glory, that they were fighting for the great king, that they were fighting for their empire. And they no doubt told stories when they came home. The Persian version, as Robert Graves once put it, that Thermopylae was a story of their glory, of their successfully going around the Greeks who were holding the pass and them winning. So their side of things would have been quite different, I think, than what we see in the film.
Let's listen to just a little bit. Here's actor Rodrigo Santoro. He's playing the Persian king Xerxes, this towering kind of effeminate, pouty, muscular villain in a stare down with the Spartan king, the indomitable and much more macho King Leonidas.
I will erase even the memory of Sparta from the histories. The world will never know you existed at all.
The world will know that free men stood against a tyrant, that few stood against many, and before this battle was over, that even a god king can bleed.
Two kings facing off there, a Persian, a representative as the personification of kind of all evil, the Spartan as all good, at least all brave. It's created a real firestorm among the sort of heirs of Persia in contemporary Iran and Iranians around the world. I want to go right now to Los Angeles to Hossein Hijazi. He's program director and host on the radio station KIRN in Los Angeles, 670 a.m. there. Hossein Hijazi, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you very much, and thank you for having me.
Give us a sense of how Iranians, whether in Iran or abroad, Iranian Americans, have responded to this film, Hossein.
Okay, the response has been very bitter, and after the Alexander that we had a few months ago.
The film of Alexander the Great, yeah, with Colin.
With the same kind of message, a lot of people here are thinking that this is something that they are trying to poison the mind of the Americans against the Iranians. And, of course, this is far too much on one side. But I will read a sentence from an Iranian filmmaker, Cyrus Carr,
mm-hmm.
who is very intelligent, and he is trying to make a very good movie about Cyrus the Great. And he is in the process of making that movie.
Another great Persian king. What does he say?
He says, what is most disturbing about this movie is not that it lacks historical accuracy. It is not the Xerxes, the grandson of the Cyrus the Great, and the loving husband of Esther. It's shown as an oversized drag queen. It is not even the outdated racist cliché of casting the Persians as Africans and the Spartans as white, blue-eyed Chippendale dancers. When in reality, the role may well have been reversed.
You think the Persians were white Chippendale dancers?
No, but the Persians have never been dark-skinned.
Yeah,
the way that they have depicted them in this movie.
Yeah, just all kinds of fury in the press in Tehran and beyond. Really interesting. Thousands of signatures in a on a petition online against this thing. Hussein, stand by for just a second. I want to take a call from Javad, Iranian, I believe, calling from Boston. Javad, you're on the air.
Good morning. Thanks, Dom. My message is very clear. This role in the film should be reversed. The dark skin should be Spartan and the white should be Persian. If you go look back to the history and some books, and you will see that Persians had blue eyes, light skin. So everything about this movie is a lie.
Javad, let's put the color aside for a second. If we could, look at the circumstances. Wasn't it an empire invading a smaller country in that sense? Are you not sympathetic to the Spartans, the Greeks?
Well, Spartan, if you go back to the history, 300, you will see that the movie does not depict what really happened. They want to sensationalize the 300 against the Persians because of the current event, what's happening in the Middle East, in Iran. The whole world is going against Iran, including this movie, which is deplorable. The Iranians around the country, around the world, are going against this movie. I just came back from a Persian-Iranian parade in New York, and there was two, three signs that said it all. I have a picture of it. I'll be glad to email it to you today.
Yeah, what'd they say? What'd they say?
Well, it says lies. This is not true. This is not Persians, but they're not black. They're not shown as this what the movie is talking about.
Javad, we've got it. I want to turn back to Hossein Hejazi, if I may. Hossein, do you see this as propaganda or as just a great old story that people love to be told again and again and again? And it's not the first time it's been told along these lines with the Spartans in the West as heroes.
Well, I see it as a cheap shot that it has been probably copied from a comic book. And as was mentioned with your earlier guest, they have spent only $65 million in a warehouse, and they made this cheap movie that shows the Iranian as monsters, those parts that they are savage and they are...
deformed, physically deformed.
Yes, absolutely. And... these are the things that really is mind-boggling to Iranian community at home and here abroad.
Hossein Hejazi, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you very much, and thank you for having me.
Let's listen to just a little bit here where King Xerxes in 300 sends an envoy over to the Greek forces who are holed up in the narrow pass of Thermopylae. He advises them to surrender. The Spartans take this as an insult. They chop off the envoy's arm. They send him back to Xerxes with the following famous exchange, lifted more or less from the pages of the historian Herodotus.
Go now, run along and tell your Xerxes he faces free men here, not slaves. No, not slaves. Your women will be slaves. By noon this day, you will be dead men. 1,000 nations of the Persian Empire descend upon you. Our arrows will blot out the sun.
Then we will fight in the shade.
Then we will fight in the shade, and Herodotus, father of history himself, says... That's what they said. Let's take a call from Sag Harbor, New York. Jay, you're on the air.
Yes, hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
I find it interesting that, you know, military history itself always seems to repeat itself, and why maybe the United States has taken to this film so much, in that in the United States battles, we've always kind of seen ourselves as a small force taking on something a lot larger. And it goes back to, you know, maybe the Revolutionary War, even up to my point was the Alamo, where it was a very small group of people taking on a large group of attacking enemy.
And they lost, but it inspired a fight that went on
right,
to victory.
That went on to actually win at another point,
mm-hmm.
you know. And also in recent movies, Black Hawk Down, very popular movie about our soldiers being shot down in Somalia, insurmountable odds, you know, coming out of there unscathed. I don't know, just some comments from your... I'll take them off air. Thank you.
Thanks, Jay. Barry Strauss, an American listener there, finding parallels in American history to this depiction. How do you feel as a historian of a classic era about parallels being taken and drawn today?
Well, Thermopylae is a classic battle. It has been referred to again and again throughout history,
mm-hmm.
For causes good and bad. You know, as a historian, I know that when Hollywood makes a movie, they're going to take liberties and they're going to take license. There's really not much you can do about it. You hope that people see this movie and then say, well, what was the real story? Mm. And that people will understand that a movie is not where we should be getting our history from.
But parallels do get drawn. It's interesting on this one. There's been, you know, different people claim different sides in this. What's the American parallel here? Are we the mighty empire, the Persia of our day? You know, who's the small number? Or is it the reverse when contemporaries look back and claim a role in an ancient battle like this? How do you look on that? With skepticism, or that's exactly what people should do? How do you see it?
I think when people can look at the same work of art and say, you know, some can look at it and say, you know, it's got a right-wing message, and others can look at it and say it's got a left-wing message, then I think it's a successful work of art because it speaks to people and they can see in it what they want to see in it. And I think that's the way history works as well. People can look at the past and take what they want from it.
How early in history, if I may ask, did let's say, the Greeks begin, or did anyone begin interpreting Thermopylae in the way this film interprets it, as freedom against tyranny? Was that a very early?
Immediately.
Was it immediate?
Immediately. Mm-hmm. Immediately. I mean, the Spartans, we have to understand, were not just a bunch of dumb brutes. Mm. They were very sophisticated, and they put a lot of emphasis on public relations and on their image. And they seized on this. Remember, we talk about the 300. But there are more like 2,000 Greeks who died in the last stand at Thermopylae and another 2,000 who died in the 3 days before. But we only remember the 300 Spartans, and that's not an accident.
The Spartans knew the value, the sort of propaganda or spin value of framing the story advantageously.
Absolutely. They had their spinmeisters out. There's a reason that they wore red cloaks. I mean, they wanted people to notice them. They wanted to look fearsome, and they wanted to project an image, don't mess with us because we'll fight to the death.
And the inscription left at the scene, I don't know how recently, how soon after the battle, but go tell the Spartans, thou who passeth by, that here obedient to her law as we lie. Who inscribed that?
Well, the Spartans. I mean, the Spartans.
They left that after the battle, or they went back to Thermopylae?
No, later on.
Carved the message in stone?
Yeah, there's no way that it was done before the end of the war. The war is not over for another year.
Yep.
But sometime after that, this was put up as a memorial, a very dignified memorial. And again, remember, that kind of statement also is a message about Sparta, because the Spartans aren't long-winded. They're yup, nope kind of guys.
Right.
And they're trying to give you the whole message there in those two lines.
I've seen the photographs of the past. I haven't actually been to Thermopylae, but is the inscription, is the stone still there?
No, there's a modern inscription that's been put up, a replica of what the ancient inscription might have looked like, but we don't have the ancient inscription.
But men of few words told us what they wanted us to remember right here.
Yeah.
Let's go to John calling from Boston. Hi, John, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
My comment is related to the homophobia that I saw in the film. I loved the film. I thought it was a great film. However, when looking at the way that the Spartans were represented, they were bearded, masculine men, reflecting typical family values with raising children, married heterosexual families, and the Persian king being depicted as this almost drag queen with makeup on, and the homophobia that's in there, and the Persian being something that needed to be defeated and wiped out as opposed to the masculine men family values.
I mean, no question, Xerxes is given a kind of drag queen treatment here, but then, John, a lot of people have looked at the depiction of these hyper-buff Chippendale, as Hossein put it, Spartans, and saw a kind of campy gay treatment there. Did you not?
I did see that eroticism, but then when you look at the family depiction that's in the Spartan representation and the relationships there and the raising of children, as opposed to when they went to the almost orgy-like scene within the Persian Empire and the depiction of how that was represented.
Right. Where would you like us to go with that? Shall I take it to Barry Strauss to look back on what the sexual mores were then?
Hey, please.
Great. Barry?
Well, again, very controversial. There's no doubt that in Sparta, as in the rest of Greece, there were homoerotic relationships, pederastic relationships between younger men and older men. Just how physical these relations became and just how prevalent they were, well, those are matters of debate. There's no doubt that they sometimes were physical. Were they usually physical? Don't know.
Was it a norm, or we don't even – I mean, was it typical
certainly,
behavior? Younger man.
As emotional relationships, yes, it was a very it was very common in the upper classes. It was very common in the military elite. What the sexual practices of ordinary people were, it's hard to say.
And what about the Persians, the orgiastic drag queen depiction here? How did you take that on board?
Well, you know, the Persians also had very similar homoerotic relations among the military. That would have been very much like what you found in Greece. Drag queen, well, that's ridiculous. That has nothing to do with the reality, except in this way. Both sides in this war would present their enemy as effeminate, and both sides were trying to seize the masculine high ground. The Greeks saying, we're the real men. The Persians are weak and effeminate. The Persians saying, no, we're the real men. The Greeks are weak and effeminate. So to that extent, the movie does capture the flavor of ancient propaganda, though certainly not of ancient reality.
Hurl the insults as the battle goes forward. John, thanks for your call. Let's go to Imran, calling from Wakefield, Massachusetts. Imran, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
You know, I wanted to say that there's kind of two comments I had. One is kind of turning the proposition about America as the small guy taking on the, you know, the large empire with the Spanish-American War. And if you look at modern day what's going on in Iraq right now, you could actually see the reverse, which is, you know, the Iraqis perceiving themselves as people fighting for their own self-determination against empire, which is us.
And some around the world certainly do take it that way.
Right, and then the other thing I wanted to point out was that, you know, we've you know, I guess through our own history, we've always kind of portrayed the Persians as the East against the West, and I think what is often ignored is the Persian contribution to Western civilization. I think it should be pointed out that Cyrus, in fact, freed the Jews with a specific intent of reintroducing the worship of Yahweh at the Temple of Jerusalem.
So there's a Persian emperor, you're saying, with a kind of more liberal streak.
Right, and I think that if it wasn't for him, I mean, I don't know which way history would have gone, but there's probably the real threat that maybe Judaism may not have flowered the way it did subsequently.
So many ways to interpret history when it gets that deep and that long ago. Imran, thanks for that call. I want to turn right now for a Greek perspective on all this. After all, they're right on the turf there. I want to go to Athens, Greece, and to John Saropoulos. He is editor of the daily newspaper Athens News. John Saropoulos, thanks very much for being with us.
Hello, thanks for calling me up.
So there you are in the homeland itself. Is 300 being screened in Greece? And if it is, how are people receiving it?
Well, actually, it opened here 24 hours earlier than the rest of the world, and apparently the attendance has been record. Village Films, which distributes the film here, says they sold 1 million tickets in 18 days, which has never happened before, and only 7 movies ever sold that many because this is a country of 11 million.
So that's a super blockbuster.
It's done extremely well. It's been the fastest grossing film, apparently, at least in the last several years.
And what about how Greeks see this depiction of a story that Greeks will know very well? Are they receiving it as, you know, a good telling, a bad telling, propaganda, a wonderment? How?
On the whole, people see it well. Down in Sparta, the film screened in a single theater, and a friend of mine who lives there told me that people came from all over the region, not just the town itself. And that movie theater had 5 showings a day. It started at lunchtime and went on until the small hours. And they were all packed in the first few days, certainly the first week or so. I think the response has been very positive, as opposed to, say, Alexander, which portrayed more than the Greeks would like of Alexander's sexual perversions and the infighting in the Macedonian court. Mm. Those are sides of, you know, the Greek past that Greeks don't like particularly to remember.
And what about the depiction of the Persians as cruel and despotic and grotesque? Do contemporary Greeks still revel in that, like in opposing soccer teams, or do even Greeks look at it and say, well, that's a little over the top?
Yeah, I don't think Greeks subscribe to that view of the Persians or the Iranians at all. I think the Greeks have a lot of respect for Iran. The Greeks have something of that view of the Turks. We tend to stereotype the Turks and ridicule them because they are our present-day enemy. But the enemies of yore are no longer to be reviled and made fun of in a propagandistic way. They are to be seen as people whom it honored us to be set up against. And because it diminishes Greeks to diminish the Persians, it would diminish the Greek victory. I think the Greeks have always liked to see, and accurately so, the forces of the Persian Empire as overwhelming and as well-trained as Barry Strauss was saying before.
John Siropoulos, sitting there in Athens, I guess I have to ask, you know, in World War II, the Greeks were famous for having really hung tough against the German Nazi armies when many other countries capitulated. Is this particular story, the story of Thermopylae, a story that Greeks still take, I don't know, sustenance from today? Is it still operative in the Greek heart and mind?
Well, people do, of course, know about the battles of the Persian Wars, Thermopylae, Salamis, and Marathon, the three key battles.
Mm-hmm.
And we also remember very, very well the fact that Greece scored the first Allied victory in World War II when we fought the Italians on Albanian ground in the winter of 1940.
Mm.
And we also held our ground very well for longer than expected on the island of Crete when the Nazis came in.
Mm.
But I don't think that people necessarily see a connection between the two. I think that it's just, as far as 300 is concerned, the Greeks are very pleased when the West remembers that they have a very glorious past.
And there it is in all its glory. I mean, some snicker at pieces of it, but the heart of the story is still moving. John Siropoulos at the Athens News in Athens, Greece, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Barry Strauss, take us home here. Where do you, as a historian, sort of say, I don't know, when you talk to Americans, the Naval Academy, where should anyone in this world, you know, take inspiration from this story? Where do you offer a caution? Is there a point at which adoration for this kind of muscle and will overcome all, where we follow that too far?
Yes, I mean, you're right on both points. I think people should take inspiration from the story because the idea of standing to the death against in favor of your freedom is very inspiring. And yet, there is a great danger in thinking that you can muscle your way through to victory in war. In fact, wars are won through cunning, through intelligence, through stepping back and saying, how can we go around obstacles rather than fighting through obstacles? I mean, the Spartans at Thermopylae were very glorious and deservedly so, but that's not what won the war, and it's not what wins wars today. So I think Americans have to be careful and selective in drawing lessons from this film.
And the lesson that you finally draw, not from the film, but from the story itself.
You know, it's worth fighting. It's worth standing and fighting and even dying for freedom, but you're not going to succeed unless you have a cunning, intelligent, and effective plan.
There's the classicist message from Thermopylae. Been back to Thermopylae lately?
Oh, yes.
Ever? Barry, and how's it look today? Can you imagine it? Can you picture the few and the many
in
narrow passages?
It's a very moving place, even though the terrain has changed enormously since antiquity. It's been silted up, so it's not a narrow pass.
Mm-hmm.
And there is a major highway that goes by. But nonetheless, when you stand in those hills and you look up, I think you get a shiver when you think what happened there.
Mm. The ghosts of Leonidas and Xerxes, Persians.
Indeed.
And Greeks down through all these centuries. Barry Strauss, you're very generous with your time and your insights and your history, and we're very grateful for it. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Barry Strauss, professor of history and classics at Cornell University, author of The Trojan War. Listeners, you can continue the conversation and download the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.